The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here in Philadelphia. It's always great to be here, even when you're competing with sleet and all sorts of good things they're promising us. One good thing that came out of it, I love D.C., but I have to now go in the morning instead of at night. So anyway, I was thinking we had dinner with an amazing group of women who have a book group, and after dinner when I came here, I was thinking to myself that one of the most one of the greatest things about books is the connections you make. The books connect you to people you should be connected to, not because of the places where you were born or because of work or because of any other expediency, but the fact that you share a space together and a space that where you share your dreams and your passions. One thing about book groups, in fact, is that the way readers recreate the book and bring questions or points to the writer that the writer doesn't know about. For example, I never knew that the private class I talk about in Reading Lolita in Tehran is a book group until I wrote that book. And then everybody told me, oh, your book group. And I thought, oh, that's what it was. You know, and it's a wonderful relationship between writers and readers, because we constantly create and recreate one another. And what I think every writer and every reader have in common, I mean, there are two things that they it's essential to the act of writing and the act of reading. One is curiosity, because you always want to know about something or someone other than yourself. Even when you're writing a book as personal as the one I have written recently, my most recent book, you still need to investigate that intimate stranger within you. I remember Margaret Atwood in one of her interviews, they asked her, why do you write? And she said, there are voices from distant villages beckoning to me. There is a bloody cleaver in the middle of the living room. And I want to know, and I tell myself, there is a bloody cleaver there. It needs to be investigated. So the whole idea of books, and as I was talking to this great group of women where Amy taught me about Benjamin Franklin, who always signed his books to a reader of books from a reader of books. You know, that is how that amazing man identified himself. Don't you wish that our politicians were more as inventive as that man? Someone said that we wouldn't like to marry him, but he would be a great friend. Anyway, the whole idea is, and like what some of our academicians tell us, we don't read books because we want to read about ourselves. It's so boring, isn't it? To constantly want to talk about yourself, reaffirm yourself, it comes from a place where you lack confidence. You, in fact, read and you write because you want to know about the other. So books are always about the other, even when they are so intimately involved with you. And in a place like this, one of the greatest pleasures of this book tour is that I get a chance to go to libraries and go to bookstores, mainly independent bookstores. And there I feel really at home, because in a place like this, you're reminded of the fact that there is a space in this world where your passport, your identification card is not based on your nationality or ethnicity or religion or gender or race or class, but it is based on that the citizenship, the free citizenship in that republic of imagination where curiosity is the password. And alongside of curiosity then comes empathy. Because you can never know another person unless you have this almost sensual urge. And you notice how the act of reading is almost sensual. I mean, the way you go into a bookstore, touch a book, talk about it, bring it home, you know, and every book cover has a different feel to it. And it's almost like making love to it. It's a very, very intimate and sensual experience. And the whole idea is that once you're curious about another person, then the most amazing thing about particularity of an experience is how universal it is. Because reading a book, what really surprises us is that shock of recognition, where you discover not how different we are, but how alike we are. That as Shakespeare, one of the characters in Merchant of Venice used to say, if you prick us, do we not bleed? Because essentially, we all bleed. And you know, it doesn't matter if you're a mother in Iraq or in Darfur or in Palestine or in New Orleans. A mother, when she loses her child, when she loses her home, a person, they all feel the same pain. And we, as a community of mankind, we all share the best and the worst. As Primo Levi had written when he left the concentration camps, didn't leave it, you know, he was freed from the concentration camps, he said, I write in order to rejoin the community of mankind. And that is what you write. You write for these all intimate strangers whom you don't know, but who you will be getting to know, who will be in many ways more personal to you than some of the closest people, because they enter your intimate world and share it, and you know they bring a flower maybe, and then you know change a little bit of the decoration, introduce you to a new kind of pastry or a new flavor ice cream, and they always add something to you. So I just wanted to begin. I have told myself, promised myself, that if I ever talk about any of my books, I will not begin with that book, but I will begin with a celebration of books. And I think especially at this time that we are living, a time where politics so much dominates every aspect of our lives, we need to remember and retrieve our individual identities as well as our universal affinities. And that is why, more than ever at a time of crisis, more than ever when our politicians and the elite have failed us, And that failure reflects something about how we perhaps somehow failed ourselves. At that time, we need to re-communicate and reconnect to ourselves, to our own nation, and to the world through the best that we have to offer and the world has to offer. And that best is through imagination, art, through thought, through paintings, through music, through philosophy, through history, and definitely through literature. So what I thought I will do today, and you will, excuse me, I don't want to go behind, you know, more than the time. You guys can start, you know, looking at your watch and coughing and nudging one another, you know, and I will get the message. But anyway, what I thought I will do tonight, I will not read from my book. Some writers do it beautifully. I think that if anyone is interested in my book, of course, they'll go and, you know, borrow it from Philadelphia Public Library or go to their favorite bookstore, but what I want to share with you is what I have not spoken directly in this book, and I thought that I will talk about the story behind this story, the process of you know why I came to write this book, because every book has a birth certificate, you know, and this birth certificate is partly rooted in the reality where the book is given birth to, is conceived, and part of it is a literary heritage. Every single book goes back to so many other books. It is sort of both burdened and enriched with the literary past. Now, this book, very specifically, has two other siblings. One is the first book I wrote. I was working on that book in the Islamic Republic of Iran in late 1980s and early 1990s. And at that time, I was sort of obsessed for different reasons that we can talk about later with the works of Vladimir Nabokov. But I started writing a literary book of literary criticism. That's what I used to do. But it didn't satisfy me. That sort of pontification for me, I mean, it became pontification, and I didn't want that. What I wanted was, I have always been interested in that intersection between reality and fiction, how our perception of reality influences the way we read fiction, and how fiction changes our perception of reality. But I could not write about the reality at different times I had read Nabokov, simply not only because of the political and social limitations and censorship, but because also at that point in the Islamic Republic, of course, the individual life was confiscated and had gone underground. That to, for example, write something as simple at the time as the fact that the first book I read by Nabokov was given to me when I was very young by my boyfriend, who wrote on the flyleaf to Azar, "My Ada, love, Ted." I could not write that. And we are a family of diary writers. My father wrote a diary addressed to me. I have it still with me when I was 4 years old. And I started writing my first diary when I was about 12. And I like to sort of open titles, give titles to certain thoughts that keep recurring. So I opened a space in my diary and wrote things I have been silent about. And under it, I wrote about a lot of things that bothered me that I could not talk about at the time in the Islamic Republic, including the fact that what had come to my country in the name of religion was not the religion that I knew. It was not the religion of my father. It was not the religion of my grandmother, who to the last day of her life, I talk about her in this book. Actually, she's on the back cover of this book. She claimed to be, and she was a practicing Orthodox Muslim, but she kept saying that to me that this is not Islam, because once the state takes over a religion, when religion is confiscated by any state, in any country, and imposed upon citizens, then it is no more free. Then it becomes, then it is confiscated and used as an ideology, like the question of the veil, which is not about whether the veil is good or bad. That is a discussion we can all have, and we all have the right to have. But it is that women who choose to wear the veil or not to wear the veil, they do it because of their faith, not because of the state. And so the state should have no power over the way a woman dresses or the way the citizens feel or their individual lives. So I wrote about all of this, as well as writing absurdities like falling in love in Tehran. These columns where on one hand I would write about the books that I read, and on the other hand I would say things like falling in love in Tehran, watching Marx Brothers in Tehran, I don't remember what else, reading Jane Austen in Tehran, reading of course Lolita in Tehran, and reading Lolita came out of that feeling, that sense of stolen identity, a stolen voice, because the imposition of a tyrannical voice, the first thing that it does, it takes away your individuality, it takes away your uniqueness, it takes away your voice, and you feel complicit because of the fact that now you become a lie. The way you appear in public, the way you act, the things you say are not necessarily the things you believe in, the things that that come out of your heart and mind and experiences, but the things that someone else who has the power over you wants you to say. And I want to retrieve that stolen identity. But one thing that very much surprised me, and reading Lolita came out of this, as well as my experiences in Iran, was when I came to this country in 1997. And It was 1997, yes. And I discovered that that stolen identity, that reduction of all these different countries with such amazingly different cultures and traditions, like Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, Iran, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, were now reduced and simplified to one component, which was religion. And that religion, which, like any great religion, has so many different interpretations, was now reduced to one aspect of it, and that was a very extremist aspect, as if all Muslim people were Mr. Ahmadinejad and at best were Mr. Khatami. And that is not how I saw my country. It was a various country with a very complex and rich history, at least 2,500 years, half of it Zoroastrian anyway. We still celebrate the new year on 21st of March, which is a Zoroastrian ritual, the rite of spring. The names of months in Persian calendar are the names of the deities, Zoroastrian deities. My name, Azar, means December, which means the deity for fire. So it is a mixed thing. We are Muslim, we are Zoroastrian, there are Armenians, there are Jews, there are Baha'is, there are atheists. It is a mixed country the way this country, which is supposed to be Christian majority, is at the same time. All these mixes. We don't say America and France and United States and United Kingdom are all Christian countries, do we? And we don't say that because this country is Christian majority, from tomorrow we all wear crosses and act according to one interpretation of religion, let's say the late Jerry Falwell's. I mean, why not? If we can do it about us, why can't we do it about the rest of us? You know, so this was the logic. People thought that I was very political. I wasn't very political. I was fighting for my identity. In the same manner that I was fighting for my identity in my country, I had to fight for my identity in this new country of mine. And I think that we all have to constantly be aware of who we are and what we want to be, and constantly be questioning ourselves as well as the world. And that is one reason one writes, to retrieve a loss, to retrieve an absence, to retrieve a stolen identity. And so that is how reading Lolita came about. But one thing, I don't want to go over time, but one thing that I want to mention again about reading and writing, especially when you go back to history, is you find out again how alike we are. For example, people in this country started calling people in Iran or other parts of what we call the Muslim world, it's their culture. When they said it's their culture, they didn't mean some of the greatest philosophers and thinkers and poets in the world. They were not talking about Rumi. They were not talking about Hafez, whom the greatest German poet Goethe fell so much in love with him that he was inspired by him and translated the Divan Hafez. They were not talking about one of the greatest epic poets of all times who wrote 1,000 years ago about ancient Persia, Ferdowsi, who is now translated by one of the by a great British poet, Dick Davis, who lives, in fact, in Ohio State. They were not talking about Sa'di, whom Ralph Waldo Emerson was so impressed with that he translated into English. People even don't remember anymore that he did that. They were not talking about the agnostic astrologer poet Khayyam, whom Fitzgerald made immortal. What they were talking about now were the most extreme and regressive form of interpreting religion. For example, when the Islamic Republic lowered the age of marriage, that was 18 in my country, to 9, would you call that Muslim culture? Is that giving Islam credit by saying it? Would you call stoning women and men to death for what is called prostitution and adultery something to be proud of? Would you call the fact that someone like the Nobel laureate Shirin Ebadi, who used to be one of the first women circuit judges in Iran, would be defrocked because women cannot judge? These are as much as Iranian culture as burning witches and Inquisition and fascism and Stalinism was the culture of Europe, and not Dante or Goethe or Flaubert or Jane Austen or Magna Carta. This was as much the culture of Iran as segregation that was happening in this country as late as early 60s, When I left this country in 1979, Martin Luther King had been dead for only 11 years. I remember that it was during the time when I was a student here that I learned about how women in 1800s, in late 1800s, like Harriet Beecher Stowe or Susan Cady Stanton or Elizabeth B. Anthony were fighting for the same rights, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton did not live to see American women vote, gain the right to vote in 1920. Someone like Hillary Clinton would be made fun of as a bra-burning, crazy feminist, and not as a candidate for the presidency of the United States, and never mind someone named Barack Hussein Obama. You know. So the whole idea that I want to make, and I will make this part quick and finally get to my own book, this book, and this is, of course, a constant ongoing topic with me, the idea of what culture is, the idea how when we go into individual stories and into their histories, we get a completely alternative view of what politics gives us. It is like reading this country from the eyes of Zora Neale Hurston or Frederick Douglass or, in fact, Benjamin Franklin and Saul Bellow, or reading it through the eyes of some of our politicians. You get a completely different view of what this country is all about. So the whole idea was that we all have something to be ashamed of. Every single nation in this world. And we all have something to be proud of. And what we are proud of is our imagination and thought. And what connects us to one another is our imagination and thought. But this book is not about political repression. History is an intersection with personal lives here, but I didn't want to write this book. I was going to write a book called Republic of Imagination. But as I was writing, reading Lolita in Tehran, the acknowledgements to that book, on January 2nd, 2003, my mother died, and she died in Tehran, and I couldn't see her. And my mother and I had always, since early childhood, a very difficult relation with one another. I always resented her intrusiveness into my life, where I talk about it in my book. She would read my diaries, read my letters, listen to my phone conversations, and then accuse me because of the things she had heard in all of this. It might be familiar to some other people. You know, these are all very universal, mothers and daughters, you know. But the whole, and you know, she was always a bitter woman. And when she died, when she died, I kept feeling that I want to carry on a conversation with her that was left unfinished when she was alive. Why was this woman so beautiful, so intelligent, so amazingly sensitive, so full of potentials, so bitter and so frozen that she could not connect to people who were closest to her, especially to her firstborn and her daughter? That was the puzzle that I felt was left unfinished. And I would take her photographs, some of which are in this book, and go in my room with a magnifying glass and try to look at her and try and discover the direction of her gaze. And so this book is partly through the story of my parents, it is about the idea of memory. Because my mother, I realized as I was writing this book that I had something to lose. That loss always presupposes wealth. You must have had something in order to lose it. Therefore, you have been rich, and you can retrieve what you have lost through memory. But my mother, the first bitterness in her life started when she could not remember her mother alive. The first thing, the only thing she remembered about her mother was the night her mother died. And I felt how amazing that if there is no one to remember you, what was my grandmother like when she was alive? How did she laugh? How did she hold my mother in her arms? What colors did she like? Was she shy? I was told that she was shy and she had long black hair and she was very slim, and she died at the age of 16 in her second childbirth. That is all I knew. So the idea was that you can, I have to retrieve, I have to talk about my mother and my grandmother in a way that there will be conclusive evidence that they have lived. And when you love someone and when you write about them, you have to be as honest as you can be, and then you implicate yourself. Because it is not just about others. It is also about you. It is not about talking behind others' back and having fun bringing out their skeletons out of the closet. It is your skeletons now. And it is not about being ashamed of an Islamic Republic or of others. It is being ashamed about certain things that you would not approve of. And you know, I have a philosophy teacher, and in... Do I have 5 minutes? Okay. I have a philosophy teacher who used to tell me, if you want to know you love a man, if you love his dirty socks, you know that you love him. And the idea behind that is that, you know, love is not about perfection, because perfection is death. You know, there is nothing beyond perfection. Life is beautiful and dynamic because it's imperfect. And people, we're all imperfect. And the fact of my parents was that I loved them, not only because of their good qualities, not only because I want to pay homage to that, but because and despite of the fact that they were such imperfect people. And despite and because of the fact that, despite the fact that they were so imperfect, they gave something to my brother and I that they themselves lacked. Like in case of my mother, a mother. I think she was, one reason she resented me so much was because she was jealous of the fact that I had a mother. You know, and not only in her personal life did she feel this absence and a proverbial stepmother, every bit like Cinderella's or Sleeping Beauty's, minus the promise of the prince, you know, but the whole, she was very intelligent. She was first in her class. She went to a French nuns' school, one of the best in Tehran at the time, graduated the top in her class. She wanted to become like her stepbrother. She wanted to become a doctor. Neither family paid attention to this ambition, nor society, like so many women in the 40s and 50s in this country. I would call her an in-between woman, a woman in between, in transition, a woman, a friend of hers whom we called Aunt, she used to say, another intelligent woman gone to waste, you know. And my mom used to say, I wish I were a man, you know. And she tried to give me that unfulfilled life, that unfinished life. Alice Siebold talks about another mother that, in the first page, the narrator kills. She starts with killing her mother out of compassion in some ways. And Alice Siebold calls that sort of a woman almost moon, because it is not the full moon. It's a, you know, only you see the almostness of her. And such women and men, they become frozen in some potentials that they never had. They cannot come out of the past. They bring the past frozen to the present. And my mother could not articulate her bitterness, so she confronted my father, my brother, and I through bitterness, through resentment. And anyway, I would like to then say that one reason I wrote this book was pay homage to memory, to the idea of memory, to the idea of the fact that we write not just to confront the cruelties of life, but the biggest cruelty of all, which is death. What do you do with death? And what do you do with the death of a parent? The only way you can resist it is through not giving in to oblivion. I didn't want to write a how-to book, not an aspirin. How to confront your parent's death. This is not what books are all about. Books confront pain. And they resist pain by talking about it, but not by saying, you know, we love comfort food. We're even using Obama as comfort food, you know. He'll come and solve our problems. No, he won't come and solve our problems. He will come and we will all solve our problems. You know, there's no comfort here. Hope does not mean comfort. They're two different things. Okay, so to make a very long story short, you might read the book even. My father was a very gentleman, and I never loved anyone the way I loved him. And all my life, I took his side. He made me his confidant. He wrote me at the age of 4, telling me about the problems with my mother, how she would not, you know, connect to him, how she would not accept him. And I begin my book with the person I loved most in my life, but I wanted to acknowledge how all my life I didn't see my mother the way I empathized with my father, but I did not see her. So I begin the first sentence in my book with most men cheat on their wives to have mistresses. My father cheated on my mother to have a happy married life, because the fact is that that was his illusion. He had married the wrong woman, and he was in the wrong relationship. Rather than coming out of that relationship, he became more and more complicit. And while both of them publicly were the most outspoken and courageous people I had met, he was the mayor of Tehran and the youngest and the most popular, and he went to jail refusing for 4 years because of his opposition to the government at the time, and he refused to leave jail until he could defend himself and be exonerated for all the charges. And the thing he told my brother and I, he said, "I don't want you ever to show any weakness or any feeling of shame. You should be much more proud now that I'm in jail than when I was out." And he wrote a poem to my brother saying that, "I am not a criminal. The criminals are the ones who are walking down the streets." And you know, that was where I learned that always you have to be on the margins of power, but it's very dangerous to become power. That is another story. But what I want to say is that someone that courageous publicly, in private life, he would lie to my mother in order to get away, you know, and I would become complicit in his lies. I would learn to go with him to his friend's house that she didn't want us to go, and then tell her we didn't go. And later, when he fell in love and finally married a woman much more dictatorial and mean — that my mother was never mean, but this woman was, he followed the same pattern. It is really very interesting psychologically. I'm not a therapist or a psychologist. I just go to some. But anyway, I don't know if they help or not, but that's another story. But anyway, so the whole idea behind this book regarding my father was also how great people, how wonderful people, how people with best intentions can become complicit in a lie if they do not treat a relationship correctly. Once you get into that web, it's very difficult to come out. There are many shameful things about myself, which I sort of evaded, but believe me, you can just read because of those things. But anyway, I want to end this story then. I want to do two things: end this story and tell an after story, come back to what I said about imagination. I learned it from my parents. It is very dangerous to not have a dynamic relationship with your past. You need to constantly revise the past as you go through the present, and have a relationship with it, and keep the memories constantly alive, both historically as well as personally. But I also learned from them, and this book is both a homage to them and a declaration of independence, because you can never declare independence without paying homage. And the whole, I learned that it is very, very dangerous, like my mother, to create fictions, to turn life into a fiction, because that is what she did. She created fictions about her past. She would create fictions about us. She would tell me, "Do you remember that day when you came to my room and you were shouting at me and saying nasty things?" And I had never done that. But that is what she believed, you know, and I would say, maybe I did, you know, because of the fact that she believed in her fictions. So fiction is very dangerous, as Humbert Humbert and Great Gatsby also teach us, when it is imposed on life. But what my father taught me, and I talked about what my mother did for my independence, and what my father taught me, ever since I was 3, he would tell me stories. And first he would begin with our epic poet Ferdowsi, and he would tell me, "This country of ours is ancient, and it has been ravaged and invaded time and time again, and its worst enemies have come from within, as always enemies do." But he said, "One thing that keeps Iran, one thing that makes Iran alive, is its poetry. If you want to think of your country, you think of the poetry. For 1,000 years, over 1,000 years, it has been the language and literature that has kept it alive." So that is how I learned that through stories, I can retrieve my losses. I can retrieve the absences. And the second thing he did with stories was that he would not And like some of our academics in universities, he would not pinpoint this story is from the East, this one is from the West, this one is good because it's Persian, this one is bad because it's, from U.S. He created that republic of imagination where we would jump from 1001 Nights and Ferdowsi into Pinocchio, and from Pinocchio into The Little Prince, and from Little Prince into Hans Christian Andersen. From Hans Christian Andersen, we would jump into Tom Sawyer, and I later found I much prefer Huck. No comparison to that really, sneaky little Tom Sawyer that reappears in Huckleberry Finn. Talk about imposing his romance, his idea of romance on reality. Okay, so that is how I wanted to end. I won't have time to read. That is how I end my book, talking about how through living in the Islamic Republic, I'll read it fast. After the Islamic Revolution, I came to realize the fragility of our mundane existence, the ease with which all that you call home, all that gives you an identity, a sense of self and belonging, can be taken away from you. I learned that what my father had given me through his stories was a way to make a home for myself that was not dependent on geography or nationality or anything that other people can take away from me. These stories could not guard me against the pain I felt at my parents' loss. They did not offer consolation or closure. I hate the word closure. It was only after their death that I came to realize that each in their own way had given me a portable home that safeguards memory and is a constant resistance against the tyranny of man and of time. I want to end because I have entered a new stage in my life with this book. And I just want to end with a few words. On December 1st, 2008, I became an American citizen after coming back to U.S. after 12 years. And I take it very seriously because I think when you accept a place as a home, it means two things. First, I always have to feel uncomfortable and start grumbling and criticizing and saying, why are things not working so well? And what is wrong here? Because you only criticize those you love, because you care. And I started understanding that I'm caring about this country in a way that is different because I'm starting to question and question and question. And so this is a good time to become a U.S. citizen because you're part of a crisis which leads to hope. Because this is a horrible crisis. And a lot of people are accountable, including us. But at the same time, hope comes out of questioning. Hope comes out of doubt. And a country that in the period of when I left it in 79 can have not only Hillary Clinton, but can have those bra-burning feminist women create a space for women so that now a conservative woman like Sarah Palin can not only run for vice president, but have a first dude. Now we have reached a point where we choose women candidates, not based on whether they're women or men, but because whether we like the ideas and their points of views or not. Now we are accepting women as individuals and we treat them as equal. That is how equality is gained. And with Barack Obama, I won't go into something that everyone has talked about. I just want to remind you of two things. Apart from the fact that, as he himself has been aware and others, that 40 years ago he could not be in many of the restaurants that now are making wish lists saying, oh, Obama would love healthy food, so maybe we will, everybody's making a wish list here. But the fact that his middle name is Hussein. Now, that Hussein, which is a specifically very important Shia name, that Hussein sends a message to all those millions of Husseins that they don't have to be terrorists, that in fact they can become presidents at some point. But not just that. He is a Hussein who has chosen to be a Christian. So who is a Christian and who is a Muslim now? A Hussein or an Ali could be a Christian or a Jew or a Baha'i. And a Jeffrey and a John and a Rachel can become Muslim or Buddhists or, for heaven's sake, atheists. This is the kind of world that we should be building. And as we're building this world, we realize that everybody is asking to be bailed out, even Saks Fifth Avenue. Now, everybody is making a wish list what the president should do. I want to ask you, in this sacred place, what about and who will bail out imagination and thought? Libraries after libraries are closing down. I was in Boston a few days ago. Harvard Square had 15 bookstores, now reduced to 2. There was a bookstand in the middle of the street saying, going out of business, giving books out for free. A bookstand was going out of business. Libraries are not having funding. I heard that in this very city, 6 libraries were going to be closed down. Humanities and liberal arts colleges, places where our vision was created, are being closed down. For heaven's sake, I just did my last interview with Day Today on NPR. 2 of the greatest NPR shows are in this city. Now, who is going to bail us out? And do we think that those men in Wall Street who lied and told our children, go into economics and go into Goldman Sachs, did they offer a future to our children? Or those politicians who told us, remain secure in your houses, we know what we're doing, did they know what they were doing? And if these men and women did not know what they were doing, maybe it is time to think that those founding fathers, Lincoln and Martin Luther King, who are now being evoked, it is easy to evoke people who gave their life for their vision. They were the most poetic men of their times. They were filled with the knowledge of history and of time. They wrote the most beautiful and visionary manifestos that the world has seen. If, as Saul Bellow says, if we are not aware that what threatens us is our sleeping consciousness, is, as he says, we do not understand that without poetry we will be condemned to atrophy of feeling. If we do not know history, if we cannot have a vision, if our children are not excited, if our children, like Donald Trump, don't come and say, this is a good time for us because we can buy more houses. If we have more Carnegies, if science is not looked at just as technology, but as knowledge, having something to do with imagination and inventiveness, if we don't have that passion, we are a country that will not really seriously change. And I want to end with this. We can ask our president and we can ask our politicians to pay attention to this, someone who's a writer and who's a reader. We can ask him that the National Book Festival in Washington, D.C., that brought 120,000 people there, should go on, that libraries should not close down. We can ask him all this. But one question that I read when I was giving the citizenship exam was, what are the first words of the Constitution? And simply, it is, we the people. So book groups, people interested in imagination, people who are affiliated or not affiliated with universities, we need town hall meetings to talk about our national soul. And what I dream and what my program at Johns Hopkins SAIS is, I hope one day we will have a march on Washington that is not a protest, but a national conversation about what are we going to do about imagination and thought. And I want to end my talk by asking you, who is going to bail us out? Have we been thinking about that? And I want to end with a slogan, because I hate slogans. Readers of the world, unite. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much. Now is a good time. Now is a good time to hear from you. There are these wonderful ladies on 2 sides of the room that will help you. I think there's a gentleman back there.
Yeah, there's one right back there. Thanks.
Hi, we're from Rosemont College, and we wanted to say we appreciate your visit there. Thank you, and thank you for speaking there too. I wanted to ask you about alimony, and how you used alimony in your negotiations with your husband.
Okay, now I have then to go into explaining something that in Islam, because women, I mean, you know, it's a long story, but there is something called mehr, which is sort of supposed to be like alimony, where before you get married, you negotiate with the husband that at any point the wife can ask her husband for a certain amount of money that they agree on. You know, and this is very important because that is all a woman could get. Like if a husband dies, the children and the money don't go to her, they go to the male descendants. And a lot of women use the alimony, in fact, to get a divorce. They say, we don't want our alimony, we get a divorce. Now, I've been married twice, once when I was very young and very foolish, something that I'm very ashamed of. And in both marriages, I didn't want alimony. It was very belittling to me. And I would fight tooth and nail with my mother, obviously, who wanted alimony. And in the first marriage, I could not, you know, do anything about it. And actually, it turned out that she was right, because my husband told me that you come to this house in a white dress and you leave it in a shroud. I'm not going to divorce you. And so my father threatened him with the alimony. And it worked. I gave everything I had, and he gave me my freedom. I didn't want his money anyway. But with the second husband especially, we had a very, very big fight because I really didn't want alimony. And my husband's family, who are fantastic, and Huma Tamawangar is among them. She's sitting here in the first row, and she's a writer herself. They were so wonderful. And they kept coming and begging me. They said, Azar, please, please accept what she says and let's get this done. And my husband would say, we all know how brave and generous you are. We accept it. Now just agree to it so that we can get along with the wedding, you know. And with that, we agreed on a few gold coins. And, you know, finally, she always won in these things because everybody wanted to get the get going, you know, and not be stuck. I don't know if I responded to your question. I don't, or did I? Where did I?
You can ask for alimony even if you're not divorced. Is that right?
According to religious law, you have the right, and people can correct me if I'm wrong. You have to write at any point to ask your husband for that alimony, for the money. Now, usually, they don't, and usually what happens is that if a woman wants a divorce bad enough, she can use the alimony, say, I give you my alimony, you give me my freedom, because she can legally ask for it anytime she wants to, you know. It's to protect the woman, I guess.
I was just wondering if you're able to communicate with the seven young students that you wrote about in Reading Lolita in Tehran and what you see their future or what they're currently doing?
Yes, well, as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, really books do connect you, not just to strangers whom you don't know, but to your past. And specifically those female students I was talking about are just scattered around the world. One is in Canada, Mitra. One is in Germany, Sanaz. Azin is in the Bay Area, married to her fourth husband. And this time happily ever after, I think, I hope. That's how she came out. She sent me her wedding pictures, and she looked very radiant and happy. And Nima and Mana are out as well. I've seen them. And Yasi was here, and she's back now. Mashid used to call me for my birthdays and for the New Year. I think I'm getting too old, and for 2 or 3 years she hasn't called. But part of it might be because I changed our home. But I met a lot of my other students. I was just in Vancouver. This has been a long book trip. And one student came and told me that, you know, she was in such and such a class and that she's in contact with my other students and she wanted me to sign a few books that she would smuggle back home. And I find, I mean, Rutgers, I found another one who says, you know, I was in the Gatsby trial, which goes back to a long time ago. And you look at them and you see, oh, my God, you know. It is a very, and you get emails. Iran, you know, is the, I think, fourth or fifth language on the internet. And despite the fact that bloggers get long jail sentences and they keep censoring, like China, Iran is far more active than China, in fact. So I can connect to my people in a way that I couldn't had I been there. Yes. Would you, I mean, would you give just the microphone? Sometimes I miss people. There's this lady, there's that gentleman, there's another gentleman.
No, I just just wanted to say the other night, I don't know if you saw it, but on PBS, Rick Steves had a travel log of Iran. He had gone in there and showing it. And such a magnificent looking country.
It is.
You know, it. You look at it or from the outside, we, you know, get different impressions. But magnificent parks and just... Really beautiful.
It is a beautiful country, and that is why it is. The other night, John Stewart, my only source of news analysis, he was saying something which is I'm diverting, but I tell you why what you said is important. He was telling this puppet called Gitmo. You know, for Guantanamo. Did you watch that? He was saying, Gitmo, you're going to get free. And Gitmo said, no. And then he said, yes, you are getting free. And he said, you know, we're going to kill you when we are free. And Stewart says, yes, I know, but that's the price you pay for freedom. I mean, you know. And he said one word, which I used to say all the time when I was back home, that Gitmo, I'm not going to let you define me. Not going to let you dominate me. And one thing that happened with Iran after the Islamic Republic was that our minds was dominated by the regime. And so all the images that come out of Iran are political images. Mm-hmm. And they're bleak images. Now, one does not want to soften those images that exist and the misery of that many people have gone through. I definitely have had my share, not much less than many others. But the country itself, is various. I mean, Tehran is, you know, surrounded by mountains. You go to Isfahan and Yazd, beautiful historical cities. You go by the Caspian, there's sea and the green. We were talking at dinner how different Iranian people look. You know, you have dark and light and, you know, that is how a people are, you know, and it's always reduced. So, yes, there are parks and Iranian women for 30 years stood up to the morality squads who would force them to veil in a certain way. And even during Ahmadinejad's time, they look colorful and beautiful. But the fact is, as Mana told me once when I was telling her, oh, there's so much more freedom. She said, you mean that before I would wear mine up to here and now I would wear it here? As long as someone else is defining your image, or you are resisting the image by, you know, putting a lot of lipstick. I never put lipstick until I went to the Islamic Republic. I mean, wasn't so lipstick conscious. So that is the point. The point is,
in that country, what is the how's poverty, homelessness, and those things?
It is. This is the lowest in the history of modern Iran. If you go, I mean, I'm very bad with facts and figures, but. At the time of the revolution, dollar was seven 2 months, which is our... Now it is, I think, 1,000. For a country so rich, it, according to official figures, the rate of prostitution, especially child prostitution and drug addiction, especially among the young, because, you know, 70% are under 30, is the highest in the history of modern Iran. So spirituality does not come out of the barrel of a gun. In the same way that liberation doesn't come out of the barrel of a gun, spirituality doesn't. And when Ahmadinejad comes and says, this country is decadent, you know, all you have to do is to go inside the society and find out. And yet they, there is a video that has been now, the Daily Beast had an article the other day. The Daily Beast is the new Tina Brown web blog. That one very influential cleric was found in very heinous acts of sex, and they put it on video, and it was, and they publicized it. And the chief of police of Tehran was found with having six prostitutes naked praying to him. And these people got very light sentences. He's out of jail, while 17-year-old boys are being executed for what they call, you know, homosexuality, which Ahmadinejad says doesn't exist in Iran. These are the problems. The country is beautiful. The people are amazing and generous. Many of the old revolutionaries are now the ones who have been to jail or are in exile because they're quoting Hannah Arendt, like Akbar Ganji and others. It's a very mixed country. I'm not saying that Mr. Ahmadinejad doesn't have supporters. Like this country, you have a mixture. He only should be voicing not the whole Iran, but the small part that he represents. You know, I'm sorry I went into detail, but I wanted to give. Okay, there's this lady and that gentleman had somebody. But definitely you, sir, after this lecture.
Okay. Hi. Ooh, that's loud. I guess I was really interested to hear a little bit about your new book. You said some about
Could
your...
Could you speak a little...
You said some things about giving homage to your parents, but as I heard a little bit in the radio program, the NPR, about the sexual abuse.
Oh.
If it's possible, if you could kind of say a few things about it and how it affected you and how you end up writing in the book. Thank you.
I find it easier to write and easier to talk to wonderful NPR, Terry Moskowitz, than to say it to your face. But I talked about an incident about molestation at the age of six, and that was one of the most painful things, and I hadn't written about it at first. I remember my wonderful editor kept saying, Azar, there's a dark side to your fantastic family in Isfahan that you're not talking about. You know, and I felt that I wrote that incident not because I want people... I hate these sensationalist memoirs where how I was molested, how I was raped, you know. And I don't want this book to be that kind of a book. But that experience defined me. It was at the age of six. It was a man who was very religious, and every time, and my mother very much respected him. And every time he came to our house, he would say to my mother, this child needs to be covered. You know, you're dressing this child too provocatively. And one night when my parents were not at home. So there were two or three things about it. One was that this experience is universal. It doesn't come out of Iran or Islam. It is the most, symbolically the most heinous thing you can do because a child is so helpless. You know, she cannot defend herself. And she cannot talk about it. And you make her complicit because she also feels guilty. You know. So as Alice Sebald talks about her rapist, and she says she writes about her rape experience not to be sensationalist, but because she says, I want to know you and name you so that I will no more be the victim of your rape. Because everybody would connect her, and she would be connected in her own mind as a victim of rape. So she said, if I know you and I can name you as my rapist, you will be a John or a Michael, and I will name you, not you naming me. And I felt that for someone like me, the only way I could go about it was to name him. I don't name him in that sense, but to come out and to tell him that I'm not scared anymore. It is much easier to stand up to militia, as I say in my book, than it is to come up with something this personal. I'm more scared of him and his shadow than I have ever been of any political foe, you know. I think in my country, now this is also my country, but in Iran, we don't talk about these things. These things happen, and we don't talk about it. And I think we need to talk, because we need to explain that such things exist in order for us to be able to change. If we deny that such things exist, then we never change. And I can't talk about other people's molestation. I can't bring out their secrets, but I can do it to myself. So that was the reason. I'm sorry that I went into detail, but I didn't know how to explain myself. Sir. And I think we have one more.
It's too bad I don't have more time to talk to you, because this has been extraordinary listening to you. I have three questions. Number one, is Iran capable, in your opinion, of starting a major atomic war?
Is Iran capable of
starting an atomic war? And number two, why the Iranian Revolution was 30 years ago, more than 30 years ago. How does the average Iranian live with the contradiction of having the soul of a poet, let's say, and having themselves repressed politically by this group of clerics? I guess that's what I wanted to know.
Well, the first one, of course, I'm not a politician, and even if I were, I don't know if I could respond to what Iran is capable of. Every place that has an atomic bomb is capable of using it. I don't think that Iran should have an atomic bomb. And I don't think it's a good excuse to say, because like U.S. has it or Pakistan has it, we should have it. If U.S. has Guantanamo Bay, should we all have it? You know, things that are not good, we should not have. But U.S. has democracy. Nobody says we should have it. Why do they have it? You know, of course, people do. You know that after Obama, one Iranian newspaper very courageously published a picture of Obama smiling, and under it he wrote in caption, "Why don't we have something like this?" And he was immediately shut down. But the whole idea then is that on that basis, I think that definitely Iran should not have. They are not responsible towards their own people. How could they be responsible towards the world? My first litmus test for any government is how responsible they are towards their own people. And that is the point. The second thing about Iranian people, I don't want to give you any simple answers, and I don't want to put all the blame on the Islamic regime. I think people are always implicated, the way I was complicit in my mother's own intrusiveness. People are always implicated in what happens to them. We wanted to get rid of a political repression, but we did not think of what will come afterwards. And we were too ideological and too political to see the results of having a system that was more backward than what we had. So that is the price we're paying. But also, Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, at the heart of Europe, for 70 years, civilized Czechoslovakia and Germany and Hungary and Poland, the cradles of civilization, had to live with the contradiction you talk about. You know, it is violence, it's trauma. It is like a woman who is being beaten every day. Why doesn't she escape? Why doesn't she shout? You know, that trauma is serious. But I want to end with this, that one of the things that simultaneously I'm proud of about Persian people is that they didn't give up. There is a schizophrenia. There is a contradiction. For 30 years, Iranian women came into the streets and they tried to resist by wearing their weapons of mass destruction, which is, you know, showing their hair and their lipstick and you know, whatever else. For 30 years, these women and young girls were taken to jail. They were flogged. They were insulted. They would come back into the streets and do the same thing. When people like Ebadi were defrocked, they didn't go home. Iranian women became lawyers for human rights and children's rights. When they were banned from certain subjects in universities, not only did they not go home, but the number of Iranian women right now going to universities is more than men. And the government is trying to restrict it by saying that, trying to pass a law where they say that each woman should go to the university in their own hometown. Like if you're in Isfahan, you can't go to Tehran, trying to restrict them. Iranian former revolutionaries, my Iranian students definitely read more Saul Bellow and Kant and Spinoza and de Tocqueville than some of my American students, you know. And that is where the hope for change comes. The hope for change is not a change in regime, because regimes come and go. It is a change in mindsets, you know. And that is what I hope for. And I hope that people like you will not just read about the Iranian regime. They will read Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Iranian history. I saw a poster of Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis out there, Ferdowsi, Rumi, Hafez, to find out who Iranians are. Why would Americans want so much comfort and comfort food that they would, you know, come to this stage that we have come in terms of our economy? Why do we remain silent? Why don't we do something? You know, crisis. There's always has to be a crisis in order for us to start questioning ourselves and the world. I want to end with hope for this country and for Iran and elsewhere. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Please join us upstairs for the book signing. It's going to start just in a few minutes up in the lobby.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.